Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop. We're delighted to have the senior, I think, endocrinologist in our area and one of the best people that I know in medicine, Greg Garrity. He is a brilliant guy and a nice guy. Dr. Garrity, welcome back to the Vox Pop. As always, everybody, we welcome your phone calls. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, I notice that at the end of every show, the lights are all on, and particularly when you have somebody like Greg Garrity, and I assure you that if you're question is about osteoporosis, or your question is about diabetes, you'll want to talk to Greg Garrity today. Right now, no phones are ringing, which means if you want to talk to this great guy, this great doctor, this is the time to do it. Now, of course, you can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC at WAMC Vox Pop. Again, the telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. I look forward to your calls. And Greg Garrity, what's hot in diabetes? Anything new?
Well, Alan, first, thanks for having me back on.
You're the best.
Thank you. Second, in diabetes, there is a lot happening. And a lot of this happening is being driven by the epidemic of diabetes. And that is not a misnomer. There are some 26 million people in this country with diabetes, 5 million who don't even know they have it. And all of this coming about because of the epidemic of obesity, which is driving blood sugars higher. And we see it in young people now. Certainly we see it in middle-aged Americans, and it's most common in older Americans. So it's a combination of the dietary change, our portion size, and our relative inactivity that's leading to this. And this is driving companies and the NIH to come up with ways to circumvent this. And not only are we seeing this in science circles, but I think you appreciate that it's happening even in political circles, where we're now trying to stem the tide, like tobacco, of sugary soft drinks, their size, all of which is thought to fuel, you know, the excessive calorie consumption that's occurring and driving the epidemic of diabetes.
So, Greg, when the mayor of New York City wants to control how much sugary drinks people have, and he's getting all kinds of abuse for it, I said on the air this morning, great, he should be doing that because, and specifically because of the diabetes and because of the weight control issues we have. Is there an absolute correlation? The heavier you are, the more likely you are to get diabetes?
Absolutely. It is one of the strongest predictors of diabetes risk, being obese. It's not the only predictor, Alan. Having a family history,
sure.
Having a history of gestational diabetes, being inactive, having high lipids, all of these are risk factors, but certainly being obese is one of the strongest risk factors.
Okay, we'll go to Estelle in Clifton Park. Estelle, you're on, and you got something to say. Go ahead.
My question to the doctor is, can thyroid problems affect or influence arthritic difficulties?
Estelle, I think if one is hypothyroid, one feels poorly, and one is prone to weight gain. And certainly this can add to the burden of degenerative arthritis, which occurs more commonly in people who are overweight and over time. But I'm not aware of a direct correlation between hypothyroidism as a cause of arthritis.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Estelle.
Thank you.
Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. There are four free phones right now. They won't be for long. So, Ann, you're on, and I think your question is almost the same. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. I have a question about hypothyroidism. I have Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
Say again.
And it's called Hashimoto's thyroiditis, mm-hmm. which is an autoimmune disorder. And I'm always in a conversation with my endocrinologist about how high my dose of synthetic thyroid hormone should be. Because of the bell curve, it's confusing to me. And I find myself often asking for a higher dose. So I wonder if the doctor could address how those decisions are made. I'm not overweight, and I don't have typical symptoms of someone with hypothyroidism. But, of course, I'm interested in having the most optimal energy level and stuff.
And
I can take my answer.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Okay. We may want to ask you a question.
And this is an excellent and a common question, so I'm glad you asked. So let's assume for the sake of discussion, maybe you'll tell me differently, that your thyroid gland is normal size and it's smooth without nodules, or maybe only slightly irregular but no dominant nodules. And if this is the case, then typically we have two goals we try to achieve when we're prescribing thyroid hormone. One is to get the individual to feeling as well as he or she can, essentially feeling normal. That's one goal. So that's a clinical measure or a clinical metric, if you will. The other goal is to get your thyroid levels into the normal range. And you alluded to this. There is not a single point that's normal. There's a spectrum or a range of normal. So when we adjust the thyroid dose, we're trying to, A, get you feeling as well as you can feel, and B, get your levels to a point where they remain in the normal range and you're feeling well at the same time.
Right.
So for example,
but since feeling well is subjective, you might go into your doctor and say, hey, maybe I'd feel even better if I had a little more of this stuff.
Well, that's right? Correct, Anne. And so sometimes someone will come in just like yourself, and we'll see that their levels are in the normal range. But we try and be mindful of the fact that we're not treating, you know, test results and pieces of paper, that we're treating people who have this condition. So we have to be mindful that even though those results may be normal, you're not quite 100%. And so we have to be open to, at least my feeling is, we need to be open to the fact that maybe you would benefit from a 10 or 12% dose increase and feel even better. And that's something I think is appropriate and reasonable to try in the individual who's not 100%.
And what's the downside of giving of over-medicating?
So, Alan, if we were to give too much, one could feel hyperthyroid, experience the symptoms and signs that one might have when the thyroid level is too high, such as palpitations, sleeplessness at night, unexplained weight loss, sweats, increased bowel frequency. And so we always ask patients, if you feel that, to let us know so we can double check.
Okay, Ann, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, guys. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Let's go to Tammy in Catskill, New York. Tammy, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about my 9-year-old daughter. She has an anoxic ischemic brain injury that she acquired from a near drown at the age of 4. I'm wondering, at what age should I get a full workup from an endocrinologist to make sure she's developing hormonally at a normal way?
Well, that's a good question, Tammy. And I think at this point in time, it might be reasonable, and I suspect some of this has been done already, regarding checking on thyroid levels and pituitary function either directly or indirectly. But in terms of when you can expect your 9-year-old to start puberty, maybe I'm reading too much into the question, but...
No, that's it, yeah.
So at that point in time, the age of puberty can be anywhere from 10 years old up to 14 years old. So there's a range. And so certainly if you don't see the early signs of pubertal development, by age 12 or 13, it's reasonable at that time to ask your pediatrician or ask Tammy's if it's appropriate to look a little more closely for a problem.
And what are those signs?
Well, you know, in a female, we start to see some breast development. In men and women, we see pubic hair development. So these would be some of the normal things that happen with puberty.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know for sure that the brain injury did affect the thalamus area of her brain. So I worry that maybe there's other hormones that might not seem as obvious or other, I don't know, even know what, but other functions that are have been injured. And I just wondered when we haven't had a full workup ever from an endocrinologist.
Right, and this could start with the primary care doc or pediatrician, and if he or she were to find problems, then that should generate a referral to an endocrinologist or a pediatric endocrinologist.
Okay.
Tammy,
thanks for the call.
Appreciate it very much. Okay. Let's go to Lynn in New Lebanon, and then we'll take a break. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Lynn.
Quick background. Non-insulin dependent. A1C was tested at 9.2. In 6 months, I got it down to 6.6. Went off the metformin, which he wanted to up me to 1,000, but I couldn't tolerate it twice a day, so I kept it at 500 twice a day. I was going hypoglycemic every morning. When I went back on the 500, I was off of it for a little while. I haven't been back to see him, but I've basically lost a ton of weight. My levels are all back to normal. Is it normal to put a pre-diabetic on metformin?
It is not currently the standard of care, Lynn. There is some evidence that it may be beneficial and prevent the development of diabetes. There's a large study that's looked at this and showed benefit with lifestyle changes being even more beneficial than metformin alone.
Right.
So
I cut out everything white. I went on an exercise regimen. And like I said, he laughed at me when I said I'm getting off this in 6 months. But I've been off of it.
Your turnaround is really remarkable, and I think a lesson to all those listening that good things do happen when there is lifestyle change. And I suspect this turnaround has come about not only because of diet, but I would guess you're getting more physically active as well.
Well, I got a treadmill in 20 minutes a day.
So my question then is metformin one of those things, once you get started with it, you can't get off of it?
No, Alan. Once you get started, you may wish to remain on it, but you can certainly come off it, particularly as in Lynn's case, where she's lost a lot of weight.
Sure.
And with that weight loss, she's seen significant improvement in her blood glucose control.
And but she mentioned the A1C level. What is the ideal A1C level for individuals?
So, for everybody's sake, the A1C is a test referred to that reflects the average blood sugar over a three-month interval. And a normal range is under 5.7, with pre-diabetes being 5.7 to 6.4, and then diabetes being 6.5 or higher. So it's a nice test that looks at the average blood sugar over the past 3 months.
Which is different from pricking yourself in the hand with a, you know.
It's very different, yes, yeah.
And the A1C is a better test, has proven to be a better test?
It's a complementary test, so it's a nice, easy test to look at a three-month average.
Gotcha. Hey, Lynn, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The number is 1-800-348-2551. We will be right back for Nancy and Delfina and anybody else who calls. This is the time to get in.
Support for WAMC comes from American Meditation Institute, Averill Park, New York, offering meditation classes for beginners working to reduce stress and enhance their health. AmericanMeditation.org. The 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, newly renovated boutique hotel in the heart of the Hudson Valley, 12 guest rooms with modern amenities located close to historic landmarks. The 1850house.com. St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. And Edward Jones, Uptown Kingston, Risa Conde, Edward Jones Financial Advisor, Making Sense of Investing, 845-331-6293.
And we are back with our friend, endocrinologist, Dr. Greg Garrity, wonderful man, as you can hear, always willing to answer your questions. Let's go to Nancy in Stamford, Vermont. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to ask actually a couple of questions. Is there any link between diabetes and seizures? And the second question is, could brain tissue experience neuropathy?
Well, let's take the first question first.
Yes.
Seizures and diabetes. So high blood sugar may impact cognitive function.
Mm-hmm.
So our ability to think clearly and accurately. But I'm not aware of a link between diabetes causing seizures. However, let me qualify that because the treatments we give to individuals with diabetes may cause seizures when the blood glucose goes too low. So when we say give too much insulin or a patient takes too much insulin relative to what their needs are, that could cause a seizure if the blood sugar goes dangerously low. So there's that indirect relationship, but not a direct cause and effect relationship that I'm aware of.
Okay.
The second part, your second question was, remind me.
Neuropathy of the brain tissue.
So when we talk about neuropathy, now this is damage to, typically we're talking about the peripheral nervous system rather than the central nervous system.
Okay.
However, there has been some recent research over the past several years looking at dementia in people with diabetes.
Mm.
And this, of course, relates to the brain tissue or central nervous system. Mm. So there seems to be some increased dementia. Now, whether this is vascular or neurogenic in origin, I'm not aware of. Others may be.
Maybe you can help us with the two terms, vascular versus vascular. I think we all know.
So vascular is diminished blood supply to areas of the brain, which may impact brain function.
And may give you neuropathy or your feet or whatever.
Well, can give you peripheral vascular disease or claudication. But the neuropathic would be this impact of the glucose on the nerve tissue itself, causing impaired nerve function, whether it be peripherally, and we know this happens, and we also know that good glucose control prevents that. But the same thing may be occurring in the brain, and this is something I'm not well versed in, but certainly aware that of the relationship between dementia and diabetes occurring.
Okay, well, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy.
Bye-bye.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Delfina in New York. Okay, Delfina, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a goiter, and every 6 months I have to be tested, but they do a biopsy. First, they do the sonogram to see if it's growing, and they do the biopsy. Is this necessary to do, or is it once they diagnose you with goiters, nodules, necessary to continue with these kind of exams?
And Greg, will you start by telling us what a goiter is?
Okay. Delfina, good question. And a goiter, Alan, is nothing more than an enlarged thyroid. Now, goiters come in many shapes and sizes. Some are nothing more than a slightly enlarged gland. That's a goiter. Others are more pernicious or worrisome, and they may include a single solitary hard nodule. The larger the nodule, the more worrisome. The harder the nodule, the more worrisome.
Why? Because they could be cancer.
Yes. We worry about the risk for thyroid cancer in these nodules. The most common goiters, in my experience, have been those that are called multinodular goiters, where there are several nodules, and they may vary in size or they may be very similar, but these two carry an increased risk for cancer, and we certainly worry about the nodule that might stand out and be different or a little larger and different than the surrounding nodules, or a solitary nodule. So in terms of surveillance and being mindful of this underlying problem, one of the tools that's used most commonly is the ultrasound, and then right behind that is the needle biopsy of these nodules. And typically this is done at least on a yearly basis. And I can see where it might be warranted more frequently in an individual with a suspicious goiter, if you will, where the test results in the past may have come back borderline or suspect. And so rather than proceeding directly to surgery, you know, the patient and the doctor may have opted for just a little more vigilance.
And what's that surgery look like? Is that removal or what?
It's removal. So it's a thyroidectomy where typically the whole thyroid is removed.
And if your thyroid is removed, there's medication that can supply you with what you need?
Absolutely. You can take thyroid hormone. It's one pill a day. Mm-hmm. And so this is relatively easy, relatively low cost to pay, in contrast to having thyroid cancer that potentially spreads, which can be, you know, a much more serious condition.
Delfina, back to you.
Yes. He's answered my question, and I thank you. But I wanted to ask you one more, if it's possible. I take Levotroxin every day. Is that also, sometimes I tend to worry that it might make it grow more.
Right. So the idea behind taking levothyroxine, which is synthetic thyroid hormone, is to, in a sense, give your thyroid a rest. And by resting the thyroid, it's quite possible, and we hope, that those nodules will, at the very least, get no larger, and at the very most, potentially even regress or shrink in size.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Delfina, thank you for coming.
Yes.
Calling. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's go to Kathy in Kingston. Kathy in Kingston, you're on.
Hi. My question is, when should an endocrinologist be consulted for precocious puberty?
Meaning it comes too early.
Yes,
correct.
That's right. Yeah. So this occurs, again, this is typically a pediatric endocrinologist because generally this is occurring well before age 10. So this is the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old who is looks like they're going through puberty, whether it's breast development or menses in a female or a girl or a beard in a man.
Is this something we're finding more of now, Greg, than before?
Yes. So we are finding more of it. And adolescence is occurring, and the hormonal changes of adolescence are occurring at a younger age now. So here again, this is not something I'm seeing much of because I'm an adult endocrinologist. But clearly, if you're seeing pubertal development, you know, below before age 8, this is something that warrants an evaluation by a pediatric endocrinologist.
And what do you think they'll find? What are some of the possibilities that bring this on?
Well, we can see abnormalities in the pituitary gland doing this, abnormalities in the testicles or the ovaries, mm-hmm. As well as adrenals. So there are different possible causes.
Go ahead.
And the downside to there is a drug that can thwart the development, but not make it go back.
That's correct. So naturally, when we're treating this, we want to treat the oversupply of hormone. We don't want to turn it off completely, but we want to suppress it to the point where it's more normal or normal.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Kathy. Okay, let's go to Phil in Queensbury. Phil, you're on with Dr. Garrity.
Hi. I have a question related to the sugary soft drink issue. What are the known deleterious effects of the sugar substitutes? Like, I like to have a 16-ounce diet soda every day, and I know there were some studies years ago where rats were, you know, fed many times a normal dose of saccharin or whatever, and there were some bad effects. But what are some realistic adverse effects of consuming something like that every day?
Well, I think, Phil, that's kind of a loaded question. I'll tell you why I think it's a loaded question, because if we practice a habit of moderation, it seems unlikely that we're going to get into trouble. But if we're not practicing moderation and
we're a rat,
and we're drinking in excess, it's possible that our risk for trouble will increase. And the risk is not only because of the sugar substitute, but the caffeine and the other components of these artificial beverages. But to cut to your question, is there a risk with the sugar substitutes? I think you'll find people on both sides of the aisle. In my practice, I don't mind sugar substitutes, but the rule is moderation.
I have to tell you that I've had to wean myself off the diet Pepsi, which I found addictive. And I have. And there have been recent studies that are talking, you know, now, of course, it's all from the internet, Phil, so can you believe anything? Probably not. I've seen studies that say that people who use sugar substitutes actually are at risk for gaining weight. Have you heard that one?
I have heard that, yes.
Yeah. Yep. So I've tried to deal with my colleagues here at WAMC on this issue, but will they listen to me? No.
Yeah, that would seem unlikely since there's no caloric content in those sugar substitutes.
I'll just comment quickly, except that this rule of moderation, when you're drinking a diet, you sort of falsely lead yourself into believing more is okay. And then that carries over into other areas of our lifestyle, including our diet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Years ago, I had heard there was maybe some link between diabetes and the fact that humans consume cow's milk. We're the only species that consumes another species' milk. And there was some speculation that maybe there was some link between that and diabetes. Have you heard that?
Yes, and that is something that has been studied in epidemiologic studies. And the link here was thought to be between type 1 diabetes, and the risk for this immune reaction.
So that's juvenile diabetes type 1.
Right. Yeah. What we used to call juvenile diabetes, we now call type 1 diabetes. You know, there are about a million individuals in this country with type 1 diabetes, including myself. And so it was at one time thought that there may be a link between drinking, you know, cow's milk or bovine, the bovine proteins to trigger this immune reaction. That has not been borne out and proven in any clinical studies, but it remains one of the hypothesized triggers for type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Right now, we don't know what the trigger is.
Too bad because the Shartok twins were certainly fed out of a bottle.
Well,
thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Alexa in Hartsdale, New York. Alexa, you're on.
Hi.
Hi, Alexa.
Okay. So I have a question relating to, I guess, thyroid. I've been going to around 4 different endocrinologists, and I have all the hypothyroid symptoms. Mm-hmm. But then my TSH level fluctuates between a 0.6 and a 1.2. And so they rule that out. But the symptoms have been ongoing for months. Is there anything else it could be?
Well, the short answer is yes. But let's focus on thyroid for 1 minute. So let's presume your symptoms are fatigue, I have trouble losing weight, I'm tired all the time, which is really a common triad in patients who are untreated. Your TSH is normal, you know, between 0.6 and 1.2. However, and I trust this has been done, that is, are the thyroid levels normal? Not just the TSH, but the free T4 and the T3. Those are the hormones made in the thyroid gland. And the TSH is made in the pituitary. And oftentimes, there's very good correlation with a normal TSH, which typically means normal thyroid hormones, but not always. So it's imperative that that be checked, Alexa. And
okay.
I suspect if you've seen 4 different endocrinologists that it has been checked along the way. So for the sake of discussion now, well, how come I feel so poorly? What else might it be? So there are some common problems that need to be thought of for people with these complaints. One is simply anemia. So if you're anemic, you may feel tired. Another, which often flies under the radar screen in the office, is this syndrome of sleep apnea, where people don't have a restful night's sleep. They may snore. They may be overweight. They go to bed, they get 8 hours of sleep, but they wake up tired. The spouse is often reporting that, yes, she snores all night or she snores all night, and all the tests look normal. So this is might be an opportunity to check for sleep apnea. There are other hormonal conditions which might explain this. Menopause is a common cause of fatigue. Pituitary problems, insufficiency, adrenal insufficiency, can lead to fatigue, as well as other symptoms as well. But to answer your question, could it be anything else? Yeah, it could be several other things. And we may find that all of those other tests, Alexa, are normal. So what's another explanation for this? Because you've had the million-dollar evaluation, and yet your doctor says that you're fine. Stop complaining. So another very common cause of fatigue. And this is not to finger point, because you and I don't know each other, but speaking in a generic sense, people who are depressed are often tired. Mm-hmm. And there's no simple blood test for depression. So it's another consideration that when we're with a patient, we can try and sort some of these things out and try and get to the bottom of this fatigue. When we often start with tangible things like we've discussed, and then we move on to circumstance, social setting, and maybe even, the psyche, you know, talking about depression.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Would any of them cause, like, a rapid waking? Like, I've always been the same way. I'm only in my 20s, and within, like, 3 months, I put on 20 pounds, which for me was not normal. And I was eating better and exercising better than ever before.
Well, there's a syndrome called Cushing syndrome, And this is actually the opposite of cortisol lack. It's cortisol excess. And that can lead to rapid weight gain.
What was that? I'm sorry.
So Cushing's syndrome is a syndrome where the adrenal glands overproduce cortisol. And this excess cortisol adds weight in the central part of the body, central obesity, and it can drive up the blood pressure, drive up the blood sugar, and it can lead to fatigue as well.
And you test this by?
We test it in the office measuring cortisol levels.
Wow.
Now, that's, Alexa, that's not to say that's what the problem is, but it's just a quick thought for you.
Alexa, we got to take a break. I thank you for calling. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Vision XL Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, glaucoma management, and specialty contact lens fitting, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or 845-336-6310. Bel Air Mountain Ski Center, now managed by the New York State Olympic Regional Development Authority, New York's Winter Snow Park, belair.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. AshfieldStone.com. And Glens Falls Hospital, big city medicine, hometown care, serving 6 counties in the Southern Adirondacks in 28 locations. Twitter, Facebook, and GlensFallsHospital.org.
And we are back with the fabulous Dr. Greg Garrity. I can tell he's fabulous. Every single phone is ringing like crazy. Let's go to Kevin in Schenectady. Kevin, you're on.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good.
Pretty good.
Just recently got my blood test results back. A1C at 10.6, triglycerides at 950, and something about plasmapheresis.
Right. And you'd like to know what to do?
Yes.
Well, an A1C of 10.6, Kevin, probably corresponds to an average glucose of about 250. Average. That means at times it may be up to 300 or higher, and at times it may be as low as 200. But
for our other listeners, that's very high.
That's very high. As I said earlier, the normal A1C is up to 5.7. So this deserves immediate attention. With respect to the confounding problem of the high triglycerides, this typically accompanies poor control, and an A1C of 10.6 would qualify for that, Kevin. I'd be willing to guess that you're symptomatic at this level, at times experiencing frequent thirst and urination as well.
Yes.
So we have a number of paths we can go down, and your doctor may have talked to you about starting on 2 medications by mouth, or insulin. And for someone like yourself who's having symptoms with high triglycerides and an A1C this high, my advice would be to start with insulin, advance the insulin, see how we do, and then at that point in time decide if you're a candidate for pills and insulin, along with lifestyle changes, nutrition counseling, learning how to test your blood sugar. But I think you're going to get the quickest improvement in your blood glucose values with insulin therapy, which will also benefit the abnormal lipids and maybe keep you from needing plasmapheresis.
So have you been to an endocrinologist, Kevin?
I have not. My doctor, he specializes in kidneys. He started me on Wanuvit. I have been on metformin for quite a while. I'm just starting the Wanuvit. I don't know if you're familiar with the Wanuvit.
I am. My own personal feeling here is basically what they've done is moved you from monotherapy to combination therapy, and I probably would have taken a different course here, moving it right to insulin with your blood sugars being this high. You know, the ability to improve glucose control with insulin is infinite. The ability to control glucose control with pills is finite. And it's rare we can lower A1C values by more than 2 points with pills. The ability to drop A1C by 2, 3, 4, or 5 points with insulin is there. And the titratability is there, particularly if you are now seeing a kidney specialist.
What does titratability mean?
Titratability means adjusting the dose.
Oh, I see.
So we can make a few dose adjustments and with the oral medication, the pills. But with insulin, we can go down a unit or we can go up 100 units.
But, you also have these newest devices like the pumps, right?
Right. A pump would be another consideration. We wouldn't start Kevin on a pump, but but for people with diabetes who are looking for even better control and flexibility, an insulin pump is a wonderful way to go.
Hey, Kevin, we got a lot of people behind you. We thank you for your call. Thanks again.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Greg in Albany. Another Greg. Okay, Greg, go ahead.
Dr. Garrity, good afternoon.
Hi, Greg.
Question. Is there any credible science behind a link between medications used for control of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and pancreatic cancer? I've heard some wisps of things, but never seen any peer-reviewed information on it.
Well, Greg, this is a very hot topic and a very good question, a very interesting question. There is clearly a relationship between diabetes and pancreatitis. And it turns out that people with diabetes are more prone, more likely to experience pancreatitis, even though it's not common. But if we look at a normal population without diabetes and one with diabetes, we'll see there's an increased incidence of pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas.
Do we know why?
We don't know why, Alan. We know there are certain comorbid conditions. So people with diabetes who are obese are more likely to have high triglycerides, which puts them at risk. There are certain lifestyle influences, such as excess alcohol, which can cause pancreatitis. We know that if you're obese, you may be more prone to gallstones, which can trigger pancreatitis. But even with those comorbidities out of there, we know that diabetes carries a higher risk of pancreatitis, a slightly higher risk. So now there is all these newer drugs, including the class known as DPP-4 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, they all have warnings about the occurrence of pancreatitis. Now, whether that means the drug is causing the pancreatitis or it's simply occurring in the setting of known diabetes is not crystal clear. But the FDA has asked the companies to put this warning in their label, and it's there in all of the drugs in these two classes.
So but about the pancreatic cancer.
Right. So to get to Greg's question, is there a relationship, is there any credible evidence? And I think that's how Greg asked the question. Right now, the evidence is very scant, and it comes from a sort of second-rate surveys, not primary intervention studies. So this is meta-analyses where a number of different studies are called or insurance data is looked at, and then they try and draw a cause and effect relationship. And this is really coming out of one large area in the West Coast, one researcher in particular, who has tried to draw a relationship between these two classes of medications and the risk for pancreatic cancer. But in fact, if you look at study data from the drug companies, this is not something we see happening. So I would say that the evidence, while it may be there, is suspect and probably not the best or most pristine type of evidence.
Just don't talk to a taxi cab driver about it, because he'll tell you that.
Now, time may prove me wrong, Greg, but at this point in time, I'm not seeing enough evidence to convince me that I should stop these medications in my patients.
We got a lot of people still standing by, but I want to ask you very quickly, because I'm not sure I got what you just said. The original question was between diabetes and pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
The intervening variable you used was the medication.
Right.
And so we don't know whether it's not the diabetes that's causing the pancreatic whatever upset, but it might be the medications that people are taking for diabetes. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, Alan.
No, actually, if I can interject, the original question, which Dr. Garrity answered, was diabetes medication and pancreatic cancer.
You're exactly right. Thank you very much for correcting me on that, Greg. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay, bye. Let's go to Clark in Oneida. Clark, you're on.
Hi, I have two questions, please. I was diagnosed almost 20 years ago now with Hashimoto's hypothyroiditis. They have never been able to regulate my dose of thyroid medication. I have my test done. They change my dose. 6 months later, I have it done. They change my dose. constantly changing it for the past 15, almost 20 years. I also was diagnosed 2 years ago with an essential tremor. Now, I'm told that some of the symptoms that come with an essential tremor can mirror symptoms of problems with the thyroid disease. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of a connection between the two, and how long do I wait? How many years do they try to regulate my thyroid dose before some additional procedure or something else has to be done?
Well, Clark, I think what I would do in this case is, and we alluded to this earlier, is we try and adjust the thyroid dose in the setting of this hypothyroidism from Hashimoto's to achieve two goals. One is to see that patients are feeling well. And in your case, that may include your tremor as well as your sense of well-being. And two, we try and get the medications so that the thyroid levels are normal. And so often we're able to do this. And there's really once we achieve these goals, there's very little need to test more frequently other than maybe once a year, unless there's a change in medication. So my first impression is this should not be so challenging or difficult that we should be able to adjust your thyroid dose so that you're feeling well. Now, it's quite possible that the thyroid dose is not related to your tremor, and that your tremor may be an independent health problem that we need to be mindful of. So I think it would be wrong to assume that the thyroid is causing the tremor.
Okay. Now, with my TSH levels, it's been as high as 19.
19 is too high, Clark.
Yes, and it's been that high. The last time I had it checked just 2 months ago, it was 11.25, and that was after a dose increase of levothyroxine up to 175 micrograms a day, and it still is an increase. It's still going up. So what he wants to just keep doing, this particular doctor I'm seeing, just is suggesting another increase of medication, another increase of medication. It's always the same thing, even though it's not making my TSH levels go down.
So a couple things I think of in this setting. One, are you taking the medication? Two,
yes.
Are you taking it as prescribed, that is, on an empty stomach and separate from your iron supplement or your calcium supplement or your food? Because if that thyroid medication has to compete with those other ingredients, so to speak, it's going to be poorly absorbed.
Mm-hmm. And I do take it by itself, and I take it every morning before I eat anything.
And are we sure? Has the doctor looked at the pills you're getting to be sure you are taking what he's prescribed and not something different?
The only difference is that they give me what they call the generic form of the thyroid medication, which they're calling the levothyroxine is
right.
The generic form.
Right.
So I've been on the generic and the non-generic, and it doesn't seem to make a difference.
My advice would be to have or ask your physician to inspect the pills and make sure the strength of the pill is exactly what he thinks he's prescribing and wants you to be taking. Occasionally, in error, we'll find patients with a supply of pills that is quite different from what we thought we had prescribed for them. This is really human error.
Yeah. Hey, Clark, I am so sorry. We want to get to a lot of people. Thanks for calling.
Right.
Appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks so much.
You're right. Let's go to Liz in Westtown. Liz, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my question. I wanted to ask Dr. Geraghty about heart disease and type 1 diabetics, particularly if a type 1 diabetic has a very good cholesterol profile but still gets coronary blockages. Why does this happen? I've seen it. I was a diabetes educator up until a couple of years ago, and I've seen it commonly, and I myself had this happen just this year, and I don't understand why does this happen.
Well, Liz, it's an astute observation, and one of the sayings we have in diabetes, and I think you know this as an educator, is that diabetes equals vascular disease. In other words, we like to assume the worst and work towards the best, and that includes good control. You know, without going too low and without staying too high.
Mm-hmm.
So diabetes is an atherogenic state or a pro-atherogenic state. And those high glucose values and the glycosylation of different proteins and lipid metabolism, all of that contributes to all that represents a vascular risk. And in fact, for those listening who may not be aware, you know, heart disease is the leading cause of death in people with diabetes. In fact, people with diabetes have the same risk of a heart attack that people without diabetes have who have already had a heart attack. So this is why we try to go above and beyond the call of duty when caring for people with diabetes to A, control the blood sugar, B, control the blood pressure, and C, control the blood cholesterol, the ABCs. And this is true whether it's type 1 or type 2 diabetes. But to answer your question, Liz, exactly why, particularly when you think someone is doing well, isn't so clear. Again, we didn't discuss the obvious risk factors, including cigarette smoking and family history. Certainly, we can do something about the smoking. The family history, we can only be aware of and act accordingly.
Liz, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
Let's go to Linda in Corinth. Okay, Linda, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I've been diagnosed with a benign tumor in between my adrenal gland and my kidney. And they're not taking it out, they being the surgeons, aren't taking it out because it hasn't grown. They tracked it for 3 years, and it seems to be just one size and staying there. My issues, however, are I have an aunt that died of thyroid cancer, and thyroid cancer and thyroid issues are in the maternal side of my family. And I'm on antidepressants, and I just keep gaining weight and gaining weight and gaining weight. And I don't know how to say to a doctor, I think I want to, he's tested my thyroid, and it comes within that normal range, but I just, you know, I don't drink soft drinks. I eat regularly. I take vitamins. I take antidepressants, and I just keep gaining weight, and I don't know how to get around. It's like a vicious cycle.
I understand, Linda, and that is challenging, and it's equally frustrating. So a couple things here. Some of these medications that we take for our mental health can promote weight gain. Even though they may help our sense of well-being. So that's one consideration. Another consideration would be this tumor between the adrenal gland and the kidney. For the sake of discussion, I'll assume is really an adrenal adenoma. And the good news is that it's stable in size, but we didn't hear exactly what the size was. And I don't think I heard if it was thoroughly evaluated with respect to function. So those are things that really an endocrinologist should be involved with your care to try and assess.
Okay. Okay. That's what I needed to know because that's the one specialty I haven't gone to yet. I've gone to everything else so my doctor wouldn't think I didn't have faith in her and she just does the TSH test and they come back within the normal range and I just, you know, for 10 years I just keep saying, you know, I have no energy. I don't even want to get out of bed in the morning.
Well, I think if you have an adrenal adenoma or adrenal tumor, then I think that's reason enough to see an endocrinologist.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we are, you know, just about out of time. We have a lot of people hanging on the phone, like Julia from Gardner, Dee from Selkirk wants to ask about Addison's disease, Kathleen from Hinsdale, Massachusetts, also Hashimoto's, and Daniel's from Stockbridge. Greg Garrity, I appreciate your being here so much, but let me ask you, who was Hashimoto anyway?
You know, I didn't know Hashimoto, and I assume he is a Japanese researcher who coined this, first described this occurrence of this chronic lymphocytic infiltration in the thyroid gland of people who had some impaired thyroid function, maybe even a small goiter. So this has been around since I've studied medicine this term.
Thank you. We're about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in and really apologize to Julia and Dee and Kathleen and Daniel for being left on the line. Dr. Greg Garrity, as always, what a pleasure to have you with us. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. And thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to our intern, Officer Eric Krupke, for answering your calls. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Shartok. Again, stay tuned now for a news update. Our wonderful Zachary will figure out some way to take care of the 2 minutes which I lost.